This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات وما في الأرض من ذا الذي عنده إلا بإذنه لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات والأرض من ذا الذي يشفع عنده إلا بإذنه يعلم ما بين أيديهم وما خلفهم ولا يحيطون بشيء من علمه إلا بما شاء وسع كرسيه السماوات والأرض ولا صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake Him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is His. Who is He that can intercede with Him but by His permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of His knowledge except what He pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires him not. and He is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Muslim pilgrims from all over the world began converging on Mount Arafat near Saudi city of Mecca as part of the annual Hajj ritual. Japan's former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is taken to a hospital after being shot during a campaign rally in the western city of Nara. And Britain's beleaguered Prime Minister Boris Johnson resigns after facing a massive revolt within his Conservative Party. Hello, everyone. A very warm welcome to World News. Our top story, Muslim pilgrims performing the Hajj pilgrimage in Saudi Arabia are now on Mount Arafat. That's where the Holy Prophet Muhammad delivered his final sermon. Mount Arafat is located 20 kilometers from the city of Mecca. The pilgrims ascended the site early Friday, staying there all day, praying and reciting the Holy Quran. The pilgrims converged on Mount Arafat after they spent the night in the Valley of Mina near Mecca. This year's Hajj pilgrimage is the biggest since the COVID pandemic began. 1 million Muslims, including 850,000 from outside of Saudi Arabia, are taking part in the annual pilgrimage. Hajj is one of the largest annual religious gatherings in the world, and it's one of the main pillars of Islam.
The biggest Hajj pilgrimage since the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic kicks off with 1 million Muslims performing the initial rites of the Hajj. First, they enter the state of Ihram before entering Mecca to perform the minor Hajj or Umrah. Then pilgrims have to perform Tawaf or circumambulation, that is circling around the Kaaba in the Grand Mosque 7 times counterclockwise. The Kaaba is the centerpiece of their journey. It's the Muslims' Qibla, the direction to which they turn in prayers.
You can see the equality of all people here in Tawaf. Regardless of their social status and job, they're all wearing similar simple clothes and doing the same rituals.
Another rite of the minor Hajj is called Sa'i. In this stage, the pilgrims travel 7 times between 2 hills called Safa and Marwa. The small mountains have now become part of the Grand Mosque. The ritual commemorates the attempt by Hajar, the Prophet Abraham's wife, to find water for her son.
It teaches us endeavor and patience, that Hajar didn't get tired or lose her hope in God and continued.
Pilgrims clip their nails or hair then. Pilgrims are supposed to spend several days carrying out a series of rituals intended to bring them closer to God.
Hajj is regarded as one of the pillars of Islam, and every Muslim who can physically and financially afford this pilgrimage must perform it at least once in a lifetime. Mahdi Abbasian, Mecca.
Former Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is shot during an election campaign rally in the western city of Nara. Now, the government has called the attack barbaric and says Abe's condition is still unknown. Japanese media says Abe, 67 years old, was shot from behind by a man using a gun. They say Abe appeared to be in a state of cardiac arrest when airlifted to a hospital. He's reportedly showing no signs of life. A suspect is in custody and said to be a former Maritime Self-Defense Force member. Abe served as Japan's prime minister from 26 to 7 and from 2012. To 2020. Japanese political analyst Shijiro Takeshita says gun violence is very rare in Japan, and that's why the attack on Abe is shocking.
In Japan, we don't have gun crimes, period. I mean, last year, according to the police, there's been only one death by, you know, gun in Japan. The year before that, only four. And most of it is due to the mobs. So this isn't our, you know, daily incident that we face. And to have that to Mr. Abe, who has served this country the longest than anybody else, over 2,880 days, and to who also created a lot of positive legends, like, you know, Abenomics, for example. You know, to have him being shot in middle of the street while he's making a speech is, firstly, totally unacceptable, and also, secondly, very devastating. Again, this is Japan. It's not United States, where you know, often find people holding guns. Again, only one death last year on gun crimes in Japan. So I would have imagined that, you know, most of the SBs didn't think, you know, that anybody would have a gun shooting at him. Possibly, you know, knives or machetes, as you just pointed out earlier, but certainly not guns.
Now, after days of political high drama, the British Prime Minister has finally stepped down. His resignation came after dozens of his ministers and MPs ditched him as they launched bruising attacks on his leadership. Saeed Peruza reports on the legacy of Boris Johnson, a man fallen from grace.
Thank you. It is clearly now the will of the Parliamentary Conservative Party that there should be a new leader of that party and therefore a new Prime Minister.
Boris Johnson led his party to a landslide victory in the 2019 election. Little did he know he wouldn't even see through his first term, undone by multiple scandals and by flaws in his character that critics say made him unfit for office. The coronavirus pandemic offered Boris Johnson a perfect cocktail of crises and chaos that shifted attention from other problems. Boris Johnson promised to get Brexit done, but nearly 2 years on, his country is still mired in a dispute with the European Union. The IMF says the UK will have the slowest economic growth of the G7 nations next year. Add to that the rising cost of living and also the faltering health and education systems. Success with the vaccine program helped mitigate the frustration over Johnson's dithering and delays in following scientific advice that contributed to one of the highest death tolls in the developed world and almost took his life. His leadership style and character flaws always acted as ammunition for his critics and the opposition.
He's inflicted lies, fraud, and chaos in the country. And, you know, we're stuck with a government which isn't functioning in the middle of a cost of living crisis.
Then came the Partygate scandal. The Conservative Party was now in crisis. Johnson received wide support for his backing of the Ukrainian government in the ongoing military conflict in the country. But the Partygate scandal refused to go away. He received a police fine for attending one of multiple lockdown-breaching parties in Downing Street, becoming the first sitting British Prime Minister to have broken the law.
Mr. Speaker, I want to apologize.
Eventually, 148 of his own MPs, 40% of the parliamentary party, turned against him in a vote of no confidence. He survived it and staggered on. And then it emerged he had known about this man, Chris Pincher's, sexual misconduct and appointed him to a powerful position still. Within days, the man nicknamed the Great Political Survivor was forced to throw in the towel. Saeed Peruza, London.
Former First Minister of Scotland Alex Salmond says the real battle in the next British government will be over the issue of Scottish independence.
Well, I think from a Scottish perspective, the real political battle is not who the successor to Boris Johnson is. It's not the battle for Downing Street. It's the battle for Scotland. If we take what we've mentioned there about the economic crisis and the huge pressure on energy prices, I mean, petrol in the UK is now approaching or even past, in some cases, £2 a litre, which is a very high price indeed. And prices are rising across the board by 10%. But Scotland is a country, of course, which has abundant energy resources, not just oil and gas like Iran has, but also huge elements of renewable power, the ability actually to produce in renewables 10 times our electricity requirements. So why on earth, under these circumstances, should the country of Scotland, amid all that energy plenty, have the bulk of our population facing fuel poverty, not be able to heat their homes? Because Scotland is a bit colder than Iran, as you probably know, and in the winter in particular, it can be a bit freezing in Scotland. So that's the dilemma we face, a country of enormous energy plenty with our population in fuel poverty. These are the issues that really matter to people, not the musical chairs and games in Downing Street and Westminster. And therefore, I think the real battle is not for Downing Street. The real battle is how the votes of the Scottish people for self-determination, for independence, for another independence referendum, as to how we can force the Prime Minister, whoever it may be, in Downing Street, to accept the democratic wishes of the Scottish people. That's the real battle.
President Vladimir Putin says Russia's operation in Ukraine marks the beginning of a shift to a multipolar world. Now, Putin made the remarks in a meeting with senior Russian lawmakers. He slammed, as how he put it, totalitarian liberalism that the West is seeking to impose on the entire planet. Putin warned Kiev and its Western allies that Moscow has not even yet started its campaign in Ukraine in earnest. Now, he dared the West to try to defeat the Russians on the battlefield. Putin also said Russia is not unwilling to hold peace talks, but said the prospects for any negotiations are growing dimmer the longer this conflict drags on. Now, since the start of the war in late February, Russian forces have taken over large swaths of Ukrainian territory, including the complete seizure of the eastern region of Luhansk. And now we're going to swing over to Mathieu Abbasian, our correspondent that is performing the Hajj pilgrimage, to get an update from close to Mecca. I believe he's in Mount Arafat. Mehdi, tell us exactly what part of the ritual and part of the rites you're at right now, where you're located, and what's going on around you.
Hi, Daniel. I'm speaking with you right from the desert of Arafat. Today, hundreds of thousands of Muslim pilgrims from around the world gathered in this holy desert, offering prayers of repentance and on the sacred hill of Mount Arafat. And this day is considered to be the climax of the annual Hajj pilgrimage. Now, I saw many people, thousands, gathering in Mount of Mercy, the Mount of Mercy, in this desert. It's the place that Muslims believe the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, delivered his final sermon, calling for equality and unity among Muslims. Pilgrims arrived in Arafat last night from Mecca, and they spent the night saying prayers, worshipping the God, and reciting Quran. The environment is spiritual. And right now, there are different sorts of programs in progress, and groups of Muslims, they are either having, as you can hear it, they are having different sorts of programs. Like this. Back to you.
Tell us what you have planned for the rest of the day, the significance of it.
Yes, yes. This evening, you see, in Arafat, things will continue until the evening. After the evening prayers, everyone will depart Arafat and move toward Mina. On their way, they'll spend the night in Muzdalifah. It's an area between Arafat and Mina, in which Muslims will comb the area for pebbles to carry out the symbolic stoning of the devil. It's a rite that will take place in Mina, where Muslims believe the devil tried to talk Ibrahim, Prophet Ibrahim, out of submitting to God's will.
All right, great. And tomorrow, go ahead.
And tomorrow is Eid al-Adha, where actually the major pilgrimage will finish with Muslims offering sacrifices and then shaving their heads. They will then return to Mecca to once again perform tawaf, and then after several other rites, they will just finish their pilgrimage.
Okay, we'll talk to you soon, Matthew. I'll let you get back to your prayers and enjoy your Hajj. We'll talk to you soon. Enjoy this rite on the Mount of Arafat, and we'll talk to you soon, my brother, okay?
Sure.
All right, bye-bye, Matthew. That's Matthew Abbasian as a Hajj pilgrim this year. Here we go. Italy's taxi drivers have staged a nationwide strike against the government's competition bill. They say the sector deregulation introduced by the bill will open them up to unfair competition from private hired services. Max Civili reports out of Rome.
Taxi drivers have staged a nationwide strike against the government's plan to deregulate the sector. The industrial action was called by a string of unions representing cab drivers in opposition to Article 10 of a competition bill linked to the reforms the EU requires in exchange for the funding of Italy's post-COVID National Recovery and Resilience Fund. Unionists say that the regulation will open cab drivers up to unfair competition from web-based ride-sharing services.
A law that regulates our sector was already approved 3 years ago, and the EU doesn't require further amendments. Taxi fares are presently regulated by local authorities. Prices would go ballistic if we let the privates take over. A deregulation would favour multinationals over independent drivers. Full stop.
On Monday, a protest called by unionists in Rome's central quarters led to disruption to traffic and buses in the Italian capital. The demonstration ended up in clashes with police. On Tuesday, tens of cab drivers gathered at Rome's municipality, asking local authorities to take their side. Protests were also held in Milan and other Italian cities. Like taxi drivers across the European Union, Italy's licensed cabbies have been protesting ever since private hired services such as Uber arrived on the scene in 2014. An endless series of strikes and protests against the liberalization of the sector have been staged over the years.
This government works for the almighty dollar, that's it. We are in the midst of an unprecedented economic crisis, and what does the executive do? It gives multinationals more privileges. What about us, the people?
Tension within the broad coalition supporting Prime Minister Mario Draghi's government was high over the competition bill until not long ago. However, a split in the once anti-establishment five-star movement, with Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio embracing Draghi's more pro-market views, seems to have calmed down the churning waters of Italian politics. Max Civili, Rome.
Now, Tunisia's main party, the Ennahda, has urged its supporters to boycott a July 25th referendum on President Kais Saied's new constitution. The party said the vote is not in the interests of Tunisians and will lead to a repressive authoritarian regime. New draft constitution gives more explicit powers to the president. A spokesman for Ennahda said the document does not come from the people or from national dialogue. Now, this as the president has defended the proposed constitution, saying that it will not restore authoritarian rule. Last year, Saied sacked the government and froze parliament. His actions have been described by his critics as a power grab, but some Tunisians, however, have welcomed his moves. Thank you for joining us, and goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
On Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The all-knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness. And I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely, thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty wise.
The limelight.
The hypocrisy and double standards of the Western countries and their institutions have deeply disappointed us, although we had previously been aware of their positions, says Issam Khalidi Ryder in an article published under the heading Hypocrisy and Double Standards, the FIFA Message to Palestine and the World. Stay tuned for more. The international sympathy with Ukraine illustrates the hypocrisy and double standards the West employs to handle this issue, as opposed to the silence and superior handling of other issues in Palestine, Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, Yemen, and Libya. FIFA and UEFA have prevented athletes and the public who support Palestine from mixing sports and politics, while sympathy for Ukraine has become part of the rituals of matches and ethics of these two organizations. The hypocrisy and double standards of the Western countries and their institutions have deeply disappointed us, although we had previously been aware of their positions. In response, many began reconsidering their dealings with these institutions, leading to a loss of respect for them.
The Russian tennis player Artem Dzyuba said he opposes any war, but he asked, why did they separate politics from sports for so long? And then when it came to Russia, they forgot this principle. Morals are indivisible. That is, one cannot respect the feelings and rights of one group while ignoring and despising those of another group. As a result, many people, including former Egyptian football star Mohammed Abu Tryka, have called for sanctions against the fake regime of Israel, similar to those taken by FIFA and its European counterpart UEFA against Russia and its clubs. An announcer asked the Egyptian champion Ali Farag to talk about Ukraine when he won the Aptasiak squash championship in Britain. He replied, we all see what's going on in the world at the moment with Ukraine and with Russia. No one should accept any killing in the world or any oppression. We've never been allowed to speak about politics in sports, but all in sudden it's allowed. I hope people look at oppression everywhere in the world. Palestinians have been going through that for the past 74 years. The neutral stance of FIFA on settlement clubs participating in the Israeli League confirms the essence of its leadership, which is biased in favor of the Zionist regime and the Israeli lobby. In order to remain FIFA president, Gianni Infantino must abandon making principled decisions that might cause him headaches, upset his position, or threaten FIFA. FIFA must give in to influential powers such as the US and Israeli lobby, such concessions being its refusal to impose any sanctions against the Israeli Football Federation and its declaration that the territories are a concern for international authorities and FIFA must remain impartial. As a result, it is disregarding its own constitution and laws. It is ironic to see FIFA focusing on the state of the sports facilities Qatar is building for the World Cup 2022, and to see it criticizing the ban on travel by the US to many Muslim-majority countries in 2017. Infantino criticized it, saying, when it comes to FIFA tournaments, any team that qualifies for the World Cup, including their fans and officials, must get a visa for the host country, or there will be no World Cup. Infantino also advocates against social ills and threats to the integrity of football in Europe, including racism, discrimination, violence, hooliganism, and match-fixing. FIFA's position reminds us of Western regimes in general that call for justice and democracy, but ignore it in their dealings with the fake regime of Israel. In 1930s, when there was a conflict in the Palestine sports arena between the Zionist-dominated Football Association, PFA, and Palestinian Sports Federation, which was founded in 1931 and re-established in 1944, FIFA did not hide its bias toward the first and its superior dealings with the second. In 1937, Khadar Kamal, president of the Arab Sports Club in Al-Quds, requested FIFA to allow Arab teams to compete with those from Egypt, Lebanon, and Syria at a time when Arab-Palestinian teams were not members of the PFA. Afterward, FIFA's secretary sent a letter to the PFA informing them about Kamal's request, mentioning that he had given no recommendation to these gentlemen in relation to Arabs and Khadar Kamal. From European and international organizations, it is not surprising to see such positions that sanctioned colonialism and helped pave the way for building the Jewish national home. racist language and superior treatment of the backward East by the civilized West, as they claim, have always been present, treating the East as an inferior species not worthy of respect but of contempt, and uncivilized people who are devoid of any potential for growth or progress. Throughout history, racism, hypocrisy, and injustice have been closely interconnected. FIFA, as well as other Western regimes, are suddenly sympathetic to Ukraine, as well as ignoring Palestine, probably because Ukrainians are civilized, have blue eyes, and live next door, as some Europeans have pointed out, unfortunately.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Midstream.
Hear me out. Spread the map of the Arab world in front of you and observe the capitals of its so-called pivotal states, and tell me about the extent of the Zionist penetration in it and the unprecedented depth reached by the official relations between these countries and the Israeli occupation. Move from the map of the Arab world to the Islamic world and see where the relations and alliances have reached between countries that call themselves the centers of moderate Islam and the Zionist enemy. From the Atlantic Ocean in the west to the Persian Gulf in the east, then from the Mediterranean in the north to Turkey, then to Sudan in the south. Passing through Egypt, you will find Israel heavily present in a way that makes it actually at the helm of an Arab-Islamic Zionist axis hostile to the Islamic Republic of Iran, Hezbollah in Lebanon, and the Palestinian resistance. From Erdogan to bin Salman through Sisi, the soldiers of Sudan and the majority of the rulers of the Arab states in the Persian Gulf, you will find everyone involved in the project of building an alliance with the Zionists, for whom the King of Jordan chose the name Arab NATO under the pretext of countering the ambitions of the Iranian project in the region. Others have dubbed the alliance MESA, the Middle East Strategic Alliance. Every passing day reveals that the new Middle East strain with American engines and Israeli leadership continues invading the Arab maps. Only a few points remain that have not yet joined the track, bearing in mind that this sacred train is under American patronage and guard, requiring all those who join it to contribute to financing it, keeping maintenance, renovating it and replacing its main station once in a while. These are no longer hypothetical scenarios, nor conspiracy theories, but rather a reality that has crystallized since the Negev summit headed by Israel. And before that, the expansion of the umbrella of the American Central Region to include the Zionist occupation forces with the Arab armies in one military axis. And much earlier with the summit of the Arab League, which was held in Tehran in Saudi Arabia, with its main theme being the removal of Israel from the list of enemies and inserting Iran instead. The project seems to be approaching completion with the expected visit of U.S. President Joe Biden to the region next month, so that all the capitals of the Arab moderates and the other Islamic non-Arab states will be involved in this axis led by Israel. This adherence to the Zionist project, which is based on devouring all of Palestine, has continued in full swing for years. It takes forms of explicit hostility to the principle of resistance to the occupation and submits the countries that conform to American dictates militarily and economically to the Israeli will. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Within hours of the Jordanian monarch's announcement of his support for the establishment of a Middle Eastern NATO or Arab NATO, dozens of questions surfaced. Who are the member states expected to join it? Will Israel be one of them? Who is the target enemy of this alliance? Recently, Washington announced the intention of U.S. President Joe Biden to visit West Asia. And according to the statement issued by the White House, the visit is part of an American pressure to build a broader security slash economic alliance that includes Arab countries and Israel. A few days ago, the Wall Street Journal published an extensive news story related to the meeting of U.S. military officials with their counterparts in Israel, Jordan, Egypt, and several Persian Arab Gulf states. According to the source, the meeting was held in the Egyptian city of Sharm el-Sheikh, and it dealt with exploring ways of coordinating against, wait for it, Iran's growing missile capabilities and its drones program. Now, to discuss this issue with us from London is Ms. Isra Al-Fas, political commentator and journalist. Thank you very much for being with us. Isra, now, MESA, M-E-S-A, the Middle East Strategic Alliance, an Arab NATO, as some is calling it, now led by none other than the Zionist entity by direct order of the United States of America. The organization is supposed to provide a joint response to conflicts, to terrorism, and above all, what at the same time countering what they call Iran's influence in the region. Although this step might not be a surprise, to be honest with you, with many in our region, however, is it applicable in West Asia?
I don't think that the idea of an Arab NATO is actually applicable in the region. We are speaking here about countries which the Jordanian king described as the one formation countries. However, a lot of issues are happening behind closed doors between these countries. We still have obvious Saudi-Jordanian differences. The Jordanians are still holding Saudi Arabia responsible for the attempted coup that was being prepared to overthrow the king. There is an escalation of economic competition between the United Arab Emirates and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. We see how both countries are going head-to-head competing to score foreign investments, each in their own economies. Those differences were even reflected in the battlefield inside Yemen, specifically in the southern Yemen. Look at the relations between Egypt and other Persian Gulf Arab states. Differences and contentions are being openly discussed and reported about in the Egyptian media, specifically in the pro-regime Egyptian newspapers, including reactions to these differences that are being put out in the open on social media. For example, Turki Al-Hamad, who is a Saudi journalist well known to be close to the Emirati regime, he tweeted recently that Egypt is a burden to its allies. This is an example of the one formation countries which King Abdullah was referring to. Similarly, look at the internal Israeli political situation. We see that it's very fragile security-wise as well. evidently by the series of defeats that Israel has experienced in all its wars throughout the past decade. Therefore, there are no grounds for such an alliance to be formed. It might be formed as part of a show, but previous experiences suggest that such an alliance will eventually fail, which makes it inapplicable in our region.
Well, Ms. Esra, do you think that the Islamic Republic and the Axis of Resistance will have some sort of response or reflection? How do you think that they will perceive this effort to create a MESA in West Asia that is namely and audaciously put out against them?
When we speak of a Middle Eastern NATO, what are we actually talking about? Are we speaking about Khaliji armies, specifically a Saudi army, or an Emirati army? Bahrain obviously is out of the picture. When we speak about Khaliji armies, we remember their failures inside Yemen for 8 years now. Hence, why would the resistance axis in general and the Islamic Republic of Iran in specific have any concerns or fears from these so-called armies? If we want to pinpoint the Israeli role, Israel has a previous experience with the resistance forces in West Asia. And the result was one defeat for Israel after the other. So I believe that this so-called alliance is no reason for the Islamic Republic of Iran. So I believe that this so-called alliance is no reason for the Islamic Republic of Iran to be worried about its security. Iran has already been there when it was facing Saddam Hussein in the 8-year war with direct U.S. orders and funding from Arab states of the Persian Gulf. That is according to testimonies made by Arab officials themselves. Israel, for instance, had a direct role in the war waged against Yemen, and this is what the U.S. media documented. What was the result of this adventure? A total failure. So any preparation for a direct confrontation is not a base of concern for Iran. We hear and see every day in the news the preparations which the Axis of Resistance is undertaking and the high level of coordination that is now being spoken about overtly in the media, specifically in the latest rounds of Israeli aggression against the Gaza Strip. So if it's about a possible confrontation, the Axis of Resistance is already very well prepared for any confrontation. As for the Israeli role, no one knows how Israel operates better than the Axis of Resistance. I don't think that the Axis of Resistance is concerned at the moment. It is for sure not as what the Saudi media is reporting about inverting balances of power in the region. This is only empty buzzwords by the pro-Israel media.
But maybe let's, for the sake of strategy, let us just suppose that there will be some sort of a scenario, or a scenario might be possible that can maybe bring about an armed conflict because of the launching of a MESA against the Axis of Resistance in the area of West Asia. In the event of this scenario, how would West Asia look like after the dust settles, maybe?
Let us be frank here. We are talking about a region where the United States of America is seeking to relieve tension. Simply because the current U.S. administration is dealing with urgent priorities, which imposes some sort of calm in West Asia. How is that translated on the ground in the region? At the moment, there is a dialogue going on between Saudi Arabia and Iran after it had been interrupted in the last year. Also, there is an ongoing dialogue taking place between Jordan and Iran for the past year. We also are following the preparations for a dialogue to take place between Iran and Egypt. All these talks are under the patronage of the Iraqi Republic. Would these dialogues have taken place had there not been a U.S. green light to allow it? This means that the U.S. has a desire to keep calm in the region. We heard recently about how the U.S. pressured Israel not to allow the March of Flags to take place in Al-Quds, despite the fact that Israel did not listen. Meanwhile, the U.S. negotiations with Iran are still on track, and it's being reported that the talks will continue as we approach the Biden visit to West Asia. These talks are currently a necessity given the ongoing Russian-Ukrainian war. The repercussions of this war have been very hard on Europe and the U.S. The economic crisis in the United States is deepening. The Biden administration is seeking to achieve any economic victory that would help it out in the upcoming U.S. primary elections. All this hints that the U.S. administration is seeking to reassure their public who are feeling the hard hits of the Russian-Ukrainian war. Hence, the U.S. seeks calm for now.
Well, it remains to be seen when the visit of Joe Biden approaches to the region of West Asia. It remains to be seen how this visit will be played out by the U.S. administration. I want to thank you very much from London, Ms. Isra Al-Fass, political commentator and journalist, for joining us to talk about this pressing matter. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about what Hezbollah did to frighten the Israelis in the Mediterranean.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, perhaps it was not expected by some in the region that Hezbollah would send a small squadron of its reconnaissance drones over the disputed Karish field with Lebanon, before the Lebanese government received the final response from the Israeli enemy to its offer that it made to the American envoy, Amos Hochstein. Yet the resistance operation came along carrying a message of support to the Lebanese state with the aim of reminding it of the deterrence power that this state has benefited from in its equal negotiating position, and a message to the Israeli enemy that Lebanon is not weak and that it possesses all the components that make it insist on obtaining its rights and protect its sovereignty. Hezbollah drones over the Mediterranean in this following report.
The Islamic resistance in Lebanon, Hezbollah, announced on Saturday, July 2, that it had launched three unarmed drones in the direction of the disputed area at the Karish field on reconnaissance missions, stressing that the drones accomplished the required mission and delivered the message. The Islamic resistance said in a statement that the group of martyrs Jamil Skaf and Mahdi Yari launched three unarmed drones, adding that the drones were of various sizes and were launched in the direction of the disputed area at the Karish field. For its part, Israeli media reported that the Israeli occupation forces interrupted three Hezbollah drones, which were heading towards the Karish gas platform. Hezbollah had confirmed its readiness to take measures, including force, against Israeli gas drilling operations in the disputed offshore areas. Commenting on this, Israeli media announced that Hezbollah's launch of unarmed drones towards Karish is a hint that it does not want a military confrontation now, but this is an indication that it is capable of otherwise, and it may be repeated in the coming weeks. Meanwhile, the Israeli Channel 13 pointed out that when Hezbollah decides so, it will launch armed drones or missiles towards the gas platforms. It is noteworthy that the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, confirmed on June 9 that Lebanon is facing a new stage with the installation of a platform in the Karish gas field within a period of 3 months by the British Greek company, which constitutes an attack on Lebanon. Sayed Nasrallah clarified that all the measures of the Israeli enemy cannot protect the floating platform nor the process of extracting gas from the Karish field, stressing that any folly that the enemy commits will have repercussions, not only strategic, but existential. Patriotic Lebanese stood behind the resistance in this new operation, simply because they knew that had it not been for the resistance, its position and capabilities, Lebanon would not have reached such a fortified and rigid position of peer-to-peer to negotiate with a strong enemy supported by the United States in this indirect negotiation on the demarcation of the maritime borders. The resistance has always chosen the timing and the action it took, especially in confronting the Israeli enemy, to be appropriate and productive in form and content for the actual interests of Lebanon and the interests of its sovereignty. It is only natural that the Lebanese today trust their resistance in sending these reconnaissance drones over the offshore Karish gas field, as it chose the appropriate timing and method for Lebanon's interest.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Ali Birro, legal expert in international law and specifically maritime border law and the issue of gas and oil in Lebanon. I want to thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Birro. Now, some pro-U.S. voices in Lebanon claim that the resistance rushed these unarmed drones, this operation that they did on Saturday, and did not give the Lebanese government sufficient time for the initiative that the Americans were mediating with the Lebanese government so that the Zionist government might need some time to respond to the offer made by the Lebanese government. And thus, this constituted some kind of a pressure on Lebanese officials by the resistance in Lebanon. How do you approach such a claim?
We should first focus on the legal aspect of the disputed area. Legally, there's a disputed area in the Mediterranean between the Zionist entity and Lebanon. This area has great potential to be holding massive amounts of natural oil that was distilled from some companies. Since it has such riches, all parties involved should legally hold all investments in this disputed area until the dispute is resolved. What happened is an attempt at restoring things to the way they should be at this stage, meaning no drilling activities should be taking place as has been warned by the resistance Hezbollah. Because obviously, the Zionist entity was not taking the Lebanese warning seriously, in a way that the Stella drilling fleet took over the extraction site and attempted to further deepen the gas well. Stena also set a schedule to drill even more wells, making way for the FPSO ship, which will start the extraction. This resistance operation resettled the situation to the way it legally should be, waiting for the outcome of the ongoing negotiations.
Mr. Birro, when Lebanon recently presented its official offer indirectly to the Israeli enemy through the American representative, it refrained from mentioning the demarcation of the maritime borders with occupied Palestine or its position specifically on lines 29 and line 23, referring only to the idea of the enemy benefiting from extracting gas from Karish in return that Lebanon would benefit from extracting gas from Qana, which is way inside the Lebanese maritime border. I don't know why would they give that, despite the fact that it's inside their own maritime border to begin with. Do you think that this resistance operation is maybe a political statement by the Islamic resistance of Hezbollah for both the enemy and the Lebanese government by saying that Hezbollah believes that line 29 should remain a Lebanese line?
I don't think so, because there were clear statements by the resistance that it stands firm behind the Lebanese government. Given that the government is responsible for demarcating its maritime borders, what happened was simply fixation of legal rules, as long as the U.S.-mediated negotiations are underway. Any change in the reality on the ground in terms of enabling the entity to extract gas or the mere presence of the Energene gas extraction vessel will escalate matters further. It would lead to Lebanon losing its rights. So this operation was a necessity. In the event the Lebanese cabinet adopts Line 29 as being the official Lebanese border with occupied Palestine.
So you think that in the upcoming position that might be taken by the Zionist entity that they might accept the offer after this operation, or might this operation actually hinder the acceptance of the Lebanese offer?
This operation comes in the form of an additional strong card in the hands of Lebanon. This hints that Lebanon has the upper hand in these negotiations and that Lebanon is serious about protecting its rights, and that Lebanon possesses the necessary power to reclaim its rights, or at least to prevent Israel from investing in Lebanese gas in the maritime disputed area. I believe that this resistance operation should be invested properly, and rightfully so, by the Lebanese negotiating team, because it only empowers its negotiating position.
Well, Mr. Beru, Hezbollah's message to the enemy came in the form of a clear warning. Firstly, about the seriousness of the resistance in Lebanon in approaching and following up this file in specific, and secondly, about the resistance capabilities, which Israel obviously knows very well. But by launching three non-offensive drones to be a gradual process, maybe moving forward towards a military operation later on or a military intervention at increasing levels in the Mediterranean. What does international law hint towards such a military confrontation in the event it actually takes place, with a maritime dispute being its main basis to begin with?
According to the Lebanese ministerial statement, the resistance is part of the country's defense system, and what the resistance did reflects a Lebanese will to set things right and put them back in place. Therefore, international law protects the rights of the countries in defending their legitimate interests and natural resources. So this is the natural context for any country that exercises its right to self-defense or to hinder any threat that might touch its natural resources. As you know, these natural resources can be within both in the Lebanese territorial waters, which are an integral part of the Lebanese sovereignty, and also a part of the exclusive economic zone, in a way that Lebanon has sovereign rights related to the extraction of its natural resources.
But before I let you go, Musa Ali, one last question in 30 seconds, maybe. In the event of a clash actually happens because of this point in particular, do you think that the American stance would still be a mediating one between Lebanon and the Zionist entity?
Since the beginning of the U.S. mediation and these ongoing negotiations, all the U.S. offers were actually in favor of the Israeli entity. The Lebanese negotiating team has not felt any neutrality from the U.S. side, neither then or now. Hence, whatever may happen, it will not change the general context of the U.S. trend in these negotiations.
Which brings us to a very important point as to why is an American actually mediating this issue when he obviously is taking sides here. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Ali Beru, legal expert in international law and maritime border dispute and the extraction of gas and oil from the international waters of Lebanon. Thank you very much for being with us and for contribution. Thank you. And please stay tuned next week for more from the Mideast Stream.
The Limelight.
The Zionist regime's so-called judicial system has not held the regime's military accountable for atrocities committed. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Ola Musa activist. This article is published under the heading Gaza Father Stonewalled in Search for Justice. Stay tuned for more. The experience of Muhammad al-Hadidi illustrates how there is no way for Gaza's people to obtain justice. Muhammad's wife and all but one of his children were killed during a major Israeli regime attack last year. After the massacre, Muhammad examined the possibility of filing a lawsuit against the Zionist regime. He soon came to the conclusion that any such lawsuit would be futile. Lawyers informed him that if he wished to sue the Zionist regime, he would have to petition that regime's high court. "I do not trust Israeli courts," he said, adding, They will not hold to account Israelis who believe in killing Palestinians. It is irrational to expect that they would. Mohammed also asked lawmakers and human rights groups if the International Criminal Court could investigate the crime that the Zionist regime committed against his family. For that to happen, Mohammed was told he would need support from the Palestinian Authority, a party to the ICC's founding charter, the Rome Statute. While some PA representatives promised to help Mohammed approach the ICC, he complained that the representatives have not kept their promises. He said, "I found that the road was full of obstacles. The stonewalling he has encountered makes it all more difficult for Mohammed to cope with the loss of so many family members." On May 15th last year, Mohammed's wife Maha and their five children were staying overnight with the family of Maha.